better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3,699 of the Survival Podcast. Almost there to episode 3,700. That'll be tomorrow. Not really a landmark episode, but that's a round number, so it just feels like it coming on up. What are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk, the subject is filtering feedback from friends, family, and the market. This is actually a direct result of the work I did this weekend on my new book, Laws of Life 2. I don't know if that'll actually be the title of it, but that's what I'm calling it while it's still in the project phase. It's working on chapter 5. And the fifth law in this book is about the fact that when you start getting pushback in the world, that's when you actually are making a difference. That, you know, if you want to be... If you don't ever want criticism, if you don't ever want pushback, if you don't ever want to be told you're stupid or you're wrong or you're an idiot or whatever else you can come up with, if you don't want any negative comments from anybody, it's very simple. Don't do anything meaningful. People tend not to attack people that don't do anything meaningful. People don't attack people who don't cause disruptions, right? If you just sit there like a bump on a log, I don't know, maybe your dad will say, get off your ass and get a job. But overall, the world will say very little to you. It'll leave you alone. If you're out of shape and, you know, kind of not really doing a lot for yourself, most people are too, so they won't say anything. But if you're out of shape and you start lifting weights and eating well and getting into shape, a lot of times people will tell you that, you know, oh, you're doing that paleo or primal or keto or carnivore thing, you're going to die. I mean, it was fine for you to eat the burger and fries, but when you throw away the fries and the bun, all of a sudden you're going to die. If you don't do anything at all, no one cares. If you put together something as simple as a video showing people how to make compost, they'll tell you you're an idiot and you don't know what you're doing even before they've actually watched the video, just because they feel some compulsion to tell people who are actually taking action that they're wrong. In the chapter that I was working on this weekend, I actually picked out a specific influencer to mention in this. It's a very lovely lady who has a TikTok channel. And on her TikTok channel, she has about 750,000 people that follow her. Most of the people that follow her are children, homeschool moms, and grandparents. What does she do? She puts rocks in a cylinder and puts the cylinder with grit on a thing and pushes a button and it spins around. Rock tumbling. Rock polishing is another way to look at this. Where you take the rough rocks and you make them into those pretty rocks, like, you know, when you were a kid, you go into like a gift shop or something like that at a museum and they have like tiger's eye and agates and stuff like that. That kind of stuff. She can't have haters, right? I mean, all this lady literally does is go, we're going to put all this stuff in here and take a look at it. How do you think it's going to come out? And then shows it to people. Yeah, she has haters. Why? Because she has success. I guarantee if she had 75 people on her channel doing that, she wouldn't have haters. But 75,000, or in her case, 750,000, all of a sudden the haters come out. This is a common thing, but it's not just haters. You see, this episode is for everybody. It's not just about being an influencer. It's not just about being on the internet. We all get pushback whenever we start to do more, or especially when we make changes in our lives that we perceive to be for the better. Some of these will come from friends. I mean, if you have a drinking buddy and you guys just get together and drink all the time, that's all you really do is drink and bitch about the world. And you start to realize, you know what? I'm spending like 3 hours a day drinking with Frank. And all we do is sit around in his garage drinking and bitching. And that's not going to get my life anywhere. So I'm going to quit drinking, at least as a pastime. I might have a drink on the weekend or something, but I'm not going to just sit around and drink all evening with Frank, and I'm going to have to go out and actually do something in my life. Frank ain't going to like it. He's not going to like it. He's going to come up with reasons to sabotage you because he don't want to lose his drinking buddy. If you have a buddy where your main pastime is the two of you go out to restaurants and shove fattening food in your face, they're not going to like it when you clean up your diet. Even if you keep going to the restaurant with them and you just change your diet, they're not going to like it. So sometimes there's people that are close to you that are like the crab in the bucket pulling the other crab back in. But then that's not it either. There's more to it than that. Sometimes your family, your friends are well-meaning, and when they tell you, I think that's a risky play or something like that, they're really looking out for you. They may not be right, but they're not doing it to be mean. They're not doing it out of spite. They're not doing it out of envy. You know, I'll tell a story when we get going, but when I joined the Army, I expected my family to be like, good on you and proud of it. And I was told bluntly by more than one family member, I was throwing my life away. I'll explain more of that reasoning in a bit. So what today's show is about developing a filter for this friction. Because if you don't take it as a whole and really look at it, you think this is all bad. But friction is not bad. Friction is a good thing if it helps you sharpen a knife or sharpen your life. Either way, friction is good. We can't really function the way we do as a society without friction. You don't believe me? What if there was no friction in the relationship between the tires on your car and the road underneath it? You ever drive on ice? Did you like it? I guess maybe if you were playing around on purpose, you liked it. But if you were cruising along on the road and hit an ice patch that was, you know, 50 feet or more, you probably didn't like it. And if it really worked out bad, you really didn't like the way you finally stopped. Because we need that friction. We need that friction. Friction generates heat. It generates resistance. And it generates feedback. And so when we get this feedback from people, we need a sorting mechanism. A way that we can say, is this person just a troll or a clown or a bitter person? Because then it's really easy. We just discard it. If it's something that's actually meant to be helpful, then we need to filter it into, well, can I fix it? Should I fix it? Can I fix it now? Should I fix it later? Or is it not my problem? We'll be talking about all of that today. And so if you're coming at this from a perspective of building a business, which is a huge part of what we teach here, it fits today. But it doesn't matter if you're building a business. It doesn't matter who you are. This applies to you. I guarantee you, when you start to do things to improve your situation, improve your life, improve your skills, improve your health, improve anything, take a class, etc., there will be people in your life who will cause friction. Are you sure you want to do that? When I bought my second home, when I say second, not the second time I bought a house, but I had a house and I bought another house and I had two houses, my brother-in-law found it to be extremely risky behavior. It didn't matter that his car payment was higher than my second house payment. It didn't matter that I had somebody renting the house and paying down my equity for me. He still saw that as risky. Does that mean he was being a crab trying to pull me back in the cooler? No. He legitimately felt that way. He just didn't know what I knew about what risk and risk tolerance really were and how I was buying an asset that appreciated in value with somebody else's money, less my down payment, and he was buying an asset that depreciates in value with his own money, and yet my investment was risky even though it was about the same amount as his. He just didn't get it because he didn't think my way. And so we need to be able to have respect for the opinions of others and yet know when to consider it noise, when to consider it signal, and if it's signal, what to do about it. That's today's show. Before we get into it, let's talk about the signal that is your tummy telling you that you want to eat, right? That you're hungry. You want to put something good in your belly. Well, I got a suggestion for you. Try biltong. If you get a hold of some biltong, especially real biltong, which will look like what's on the screen right now if you're in the video side of things for the podcast. You see how the meat there has a red tint to it? It doesn't look like jerky because it's not jerky. It's biltong. When somebody tells you biltong is jerky, don't listen to them. They don't know anything about biltong. They might not be a bad person, but you're getting noise, not a signal. Biltong is delicious, and it has its origins in South Africa. And Anton, who runs BiltongUSA.com, makes biltong the South African way because he himself is from South Africa. This is a company that was launched right in the middle of the pandemic. He had just opened a small grocery and little cafe, and he was looking for something that he could actually make a living on shipping because the whole world got shut down. He adapted, took his knowledge of biltong, and created Biltong USA. You can also get some really amazing dry sausages there called Doers, And those are awesome. Actually, they're the thing I like the best. I actually like the Jewworth sausages more than the Biltong. Probably because I can make Biltong anytime I want to. The Jewworths would be a lot of work for me to be making here at home. Check it out today, BiltongUSA.com. Next, though, today, USABerkeyFilters.com from Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason. Water is life, is the old saying. And I'll tell you that there's a reason that's the old saying, because it's true. If you take away food from somebody, they'll be okay for at least a couple weeks. They'll make it. They may not be happy. You take water away from somebody for 2 to 3 days, they're going to end up dead. Honestly, if you take away water from someone on a really hot day where they can't get out of the heat, they ain't going to make it through a day. People pass out in a single day all the time from dehydration and heat stroke and things like that. So we know water is life. The other thing we know is that the water we're drinking out of our sink may not be the healthiest water in the world for us to drink, depending on the chemicals that they're putting in there on purpose and the chemicals that leach into the system along the way. You ever get a boil water advisory or hear about other people doing it? You know what happens when that goes down? So somebody gets sick, then they figure out it's the water, and then they tell you to boil the water. Okay, or for who knows how long. And those of you like me on a well, we think, oh, we're good. But if our well gets contaminated, the only way we know is if we do independent testing ourselves. By using a Berkey, you don't have to worry about it. And I'm just going to tell you, I think that the water just happens to taste better anyway. So check out USABerkeyFilters.com today and do business with Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason, the original Berkey Guy, not some Johnny come lately. All right, with that, let's get into this again. Let's start off with this whole concept of feedback. And I like to break it into the concept of signal and noise, but we just have to start out with a realization that not all feedback is equal. And it's pretty easy to understand. It's pretty easy to understand. Here's why. Let's say that you're getting feedback from someone. You're in an industry. We call it the ABC industry, whatever that means. It doesn't matter. It's a variable. You're in the ABC industry, and you're getting feedback from someone that's been in the ABC industry for 30 years and has been very successful in the ABC industry. You're also getting feedback from your brother who loves you and has given you the best advice he's capable of, and he doesn't know anything about the ABC industry. He's never had a job in it. He's never been a customer of it, and he's never even run a business, and he's given you advice. The other guy doesn't give a shit about you, but for some reason or another, you've piqued you a little bit of advice, and your brother loves you. He donated a kidney to save your life, and he's giving you advice, but he doesn't know anything about the industry he's giving you advice on. Whose advice would you take more seriously? Well, probably the random stranger that you can verify has been in that industry for 30 years, and you should, because he knows what he's talking about. That's about taking advice from the competent versus the incompetent. It doesn't matter that your brother loves you. He doesn't know the subject matter. So there's no way the feedback can be seen as equal. On another note, though, if you're getting advice from someone that doesn't know you from Adam, and it's about a personal issue in your life, and your brother knows about the personal issue in your life, he's probably got better signal coming to you than this stranger, even if they mean well. So that's before we even get into the trolls, right? The you suck, you don't know what you're doing. Then you got all these people that throw things at you like, you should really fill in the blank, right? I all the time, you need a GoPro camera. Yeah, really, mail me one, and then mail me somebody to download the video work and do all the editing so that I can add one more thing to my life so I can deliver it to you. It's not. And we're back. I really don't know what happened. My router says everything is happy and copacetic, but clearly we're having internet issues. So I am now tethered to my phone, and we'll do our best to go forward. I don't remember exactly where I was, so I'll do my best to get back where we were. And I apologize for the disruption, but at least we're able to use redundant technology. 2 is 1, 1 is none. If anybody could let me know with the tether if I'm having any problems or skipping, or if you read me loud and clear, that would be good. For those on the audio, I will delete that long, empty space that everybody else had to deal with. You didn't, but you're hearing me tell you it happened. All right, so here is where I want to go to next, kind of friends and family. Friends and family can mean well, but still miss the mark because they don't know you. They don't know what you know, They don't know what you know about the situation, but they don't know what you know about yourself, even if you tell them. And what I mean by that is we have all had the situation where somebody sits down with us and explains the situation in their life, and they tell us whether or not they actually want to do a thing, whether or not they feel capable of doing a thing, whether or not they want to do a thing. And we only take in about maybe, for really good listeners, half to 70% of that information. Because what we're thinking is, oh, we're making our own preconceptions about their opinion, about their own ability, desires, dreams, etc., based on our own point of reference, not theirs. So when somebody does it for you, they're doing the same thing. It doesn't matter at all that you've explained it perfectly. They didn't hear it, and it's human nature. There's not a lot of ways around it. No matter how good a listener they are and no matter how good of a communicator you are, there's going to be something lost. And what I mean by that is I often liken things like this to watching the sunrise or watching the sunset. I cannot go outside at night and watch the sunset for you. Neither can you do it for me. And no matter how well you can communicate what it looked like, you can't see it the way I would see it, and I can't see it the way you see it, because we have our own frame of reference for what we're looking at. You know, what you see is an angel with a bloody sword in the sky, in the words of a Jimmy Buffett cover song. I might see as a dragon. Who knows? Like, just that's one thing. I'm blind in one eye. There's no possible way it looks the same as it does to you and I. I probably see red and orange a little bit differently than you do. I can't do it for you, and you can't do it for me. And so your friends and family, when they're advising you on a major decision in your life, they can't do it for you either. They can never understand it. And there's also a propensity, especially with older people, to look at their children, their grandchildren, their nieces, their nephews, etc., and have a little bit of a desire to live vicariously. So now I'll tell you about when I joined the military at 17. So when I joined the military at 17, I did all of the discussions, everything with the recruiter on my own. I did not involve my father, who was at least in my life, sort of, at all, and I didn't involve my mother, who was not in my life at all, right? I did it all on my own. But then you get to the point where, okay, well, you got to sign here. Well, the thing is, I'm 17, so I need a parent. So I had to go to my father and say, will you do this? He didn't like the idea, but he told me he didn't like the idea. He said, are you sure this is what you want to do? And I said, yeah, give me it. And he signed it. Actually, the recruiter tracked him down. He called me at a friend's house and asked me, do I sign the paper or do I punch him in the face? And when I said, just sign the paper, Dad, he did so. But then later we talked about it one time, and that was fine. The rest of my family lost their minds. They lost their minds. You're throwing your life away. You have such a future ahead of you. Why are you doing this? And this was kind of perplexing to me at that age, because my family is a family of service members. Both of my grandfathers are World War II veterans. I have numerous uncles and great uncles, World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, Vietnam War veterans. Now looking back, that might have had something to do with why they didn't want me to do it, even though, you know, Iraq blew up right after I enlisted. In fact, Iraq invaded Kuwait on my 18th birthday. But at the time that I joined, because I signed the paperwork in March of 1990, it was peace. No one was even thinking that way. It was more that what they always labored under was Jack's really smart. He's a really smart kid, and he would be getting straight A's in school if he just tried. Because I was like what I call an AC/DC student, right? Not rock and roll AC/DC, right? AC/DC in that if it was an easy course, I got an A. If it was an interesting course, to me, I got an A. It could even be really hard. Advanced chem, I got an A, right? Not an easy course, but it was interesting to me. So other courses that I found disinteresting, I got a C or a D in. I did just enough to get the hell out of school. My family always labored under the concept that one day, little Jackie is going to buckle down and do the other things and get into a really prestigious school and go get a degree. And the thing is, by the time they were saying this, that ship had sailed. This was, you know, the spring of my senior year in high school. You can't go back and redo those years and change those grades. And even at the point that I was at, if I'd gone straight A's through, this is just the last quarter of the last year. I wasn't going to Harvard or Yale or Princeton or even Penn State. right? I would have had to go to like a Kutztown University or something, which is a like a Pennsylvania public education college or something like that. It was never going to happen. But they couldn't see that. They also couldn't see that it would have been a waste for me. That I would have treated, I could have gotten to some college somewhere, and I would have treated it exactly like high school. A place to have friends, chase girls, do the work on the courses I liked, and half-ass everything I didn't find interesting. And there would have been a lot that I didn't find interesting. There was no place for me that made sense in my life, at that point anyway, in college. So because they thought that it was the right path for me, they legitimately were saying a pretty horrible thing if you think about it. A 17-year-old, I'm not saying I'm going to enlist. I've enlisted. I have a contract. I am leaving on this date, right? You have wasted your life. 17-year-old kid. Horrible, horrible thing to tell a kid, but they meant well. They meant well for two reasons. One, they had a vision for me that was not my own. And two, I'm going to tell you, a lot of them, especially the older ones, who felt I should have done something like this with my life, wanted me to do it so somehow they would feel better about their own choice not to. This is a burden that you should never put on anybody, but especially people younger than you, your kids, your grandchildren, your nieces, and your nephews. You had your shot. You got to do what you wanted to do. And you might think, man, if I could go back and do it again, I would do this, 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 and this. That has nothing to do with what that young person is planning to do. So we always have to be aware of that. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, 15 or 50, this dynamic will still play out. Now, the market is different. Your family is almost, unless you have a really passive-aggressive or mentally screwed-up person in your family that's just the kind of person that you wish wasn't in your family, I'll put it that way. It's almost always the case if they give you advice or tell you what you should be doing or tell you what you shouldn't be doing, it's always well-meaning. The market gives you not just signal, right, because you have a poor-quality signal or a high-quality signal from a family member. The market gives you both poor quality and high quality signals, but it also gives you noise, static. And that's because when you're in the marketplace, you have a lot of people seeing you and what you're doing. And the more you market yourself and the bigger you become, the more that's the case. And it doesn't matter if you run a used tire shop like my dad did, run a podcast with a video feed like I do, or you're a middle-aged soccer mom polishing rocks. It doesn't matter. You are going to now brush up against thousands, possibly tens or hundreds of thousands of people every given year. Some portion of those people are going to have hate for you. Why? Primarily because you're forcing change. Now, if you're Uber, of course, the taxi industry hates you. If you're Airbnb, of course, the hotel industry hates you because that's B2B friction, right? Now you're disrupting an entire industry. Most of the people listening to this show will never disrupt an entire industry. Maybe half of the percent will have some hand in disrupting an entire industry. So what change are you forcing when you're a middle-aged rock-polishing soccer mom teaching kids how to polish agate and rose quartz and tiger eye? You're forcing a change in the mindset of the person looking at you. I know exactly what's in this hater's head that has to take time. This loser, this sorry, pathetic little twit of a human, it's almost always guys in this type of scenario too, that's attacking this lady. What it really is that person is thinking, why is she successful? I mean, you don't even know what she looks like. All you see is kind of like the stuff she's working on in her hands and hear her voice, which is quite lovely, but all she does is put stuff in and say, we tumbled this one for 21 days and here's what it looks like, and ask her followers, should we tumble it longer? Should we tumble? It's too simple. It doesn't make any sense to the troll. That troll is angry because he's in cognitive dissonance. He's worked so hard, at least he believes he has, because usually they haven't, but let's say he did at whatever he's done, and he feels like somehow he comes across this person's content. How the hell does this person have so much success and I have so little? Usually these people are also narcissistic as well. They have these views of grandeur that, like, everybody should listen to them, right? These are the people that tell you that you need a smoke alarm while there's smoke coming out of the roof of their house. And you're like, dude, I think your house is on fire. They're like, you need a smoke alarm. These are those people. And the market is full of those people. Now, the market is also full of people who like what you're doing or want more of what you're doing or want more from you or want a new feature set in your software product suite, all of these things. And so we're going to get in a little bit to where you have to figure out, even when it's legitimate feedback, well, do I act on it now? Do I act on it later? Or do I say this isn't my burden? And the market's going to give you both of the, you know, all of those types of signals. There's actually multiple outputs in this filtering formula. You're going to have times where people legitimately are asking for something that really would make whatever you do better, but you can't do it because you don't have the time. One of the realities here is, and this is something you learn as you become more and more successful, and there's more and more demands on your time. And it's not just ducking out for a few minutes to go get an extra cup of coffee at the break room. You're actually building something in your life. Time starts to become limited. And this doesn't, you don't have to be in business. If you are a high-level employee and your boss comes to you and says, I want this, this, and this, there's a point of pushback where you have to tell your boss, look, you can have two of the three things this week. I don't have the ability to give you all three. You can yell, you can fire me, you can cut my, you can do whatever you want. I cannot do all three of these things. So together we need to figure out with priority, which two of the three things am I going to give you this week and which one am I going to give you next week? In other words, you have to get to a point where you start saying no to things, even if they're legitimate things. If I took every speaking invitation that I got, right? And we're back. The phone died, but now the network's back in the home. Anyway, I could probably do nothing with my career other than publicly speak, but that's not the life I want for myself. So I, right out of the gate, I have to say no to certain public speaking events. I don't, and if I say yes to one, immediately I know I'm saying no to another one. So I have to be selective with it. And it's everything in your business. I came up with an idea for a new business today. I explored it. I think it's a fantastic idea. I don't know if I'll pursue it, but I know if I pursue it, then something else doesn't get done. And so successful people have to say no. And that includes feedback, real signal from the market. I can't do everything that you're asking me to do. And here's how I explain it in the best way that I can. Think of Apple, the giant corporation Apple. Now, Apple and its iPhone, it's the most successful phone on planet Earth, certainly the most successful smartphone. If you add up all of the other phones, they outsell Apple. But if you go, you know, individual phone categories, the iPhone outsells everything. It is definitely lacking some features that, let's say, Android has. And Android users will rightfully say, I can do this, 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 and this. And those features you just got, or that enhancement to the camera you just got, or whatever you're so happy about from the newest iPhone. Well, yeah, we had that 4 years ago. It doesn't matter. Apple still has the number one selling phone on the planet. They have the installed base, and they've been very effective at marketing. They also do about $400 billion a year in sales. $400 billion. Billion with a B, not 400 million, $400 billion a year, all products, all markets, 400 billion. Okay. They have some of the best engineers, programmers, developers, troubleshooters on the planet. They have massive infrastructure. They can ship a product to anywhere in the world. They can deliver a signal to almost anywhere in the world with agreements they have with various carriers and other providers. They have an entire department for public relations that's bigger than most companies' full company. They have an entire marketing department that's bigger than most companies' entire company. They have more resources than, I would say, there's probably maybe 50 companies in the world that would get into their category with the level of resources they have available to them. Is everybody happy with Apple? No. Do people ask Apple to add feature sets and things to their software suite, their phone, et cetera, that are legitimate, non-hater, non-sniper, non-troll-like requests? Sure. Has Apple failed to do some of what looks like the most basic, easy things to do for so long that some people literally feel, including me, that sometimes Apple comes across as, We'll tell our customers what they want, how they want it, and when they want it, and they will want it when we tell them the way that we say it, right? They definitely have that vibe, and there's definitely people that feel that way about Apple, okay? Why do I say all that? Well, number one, I'm sitting here streaming to you on a MacBook, okay? So I'm using an Apple product while I complain about them. That says something, doesn't it? But my question for you is, if Apple has all of this resource capability, all these programmers, engineers, a PR department, do you think that Apple would love it if everybody loved everything about them? Don't you think that's actually what their real goal is? Wouldn't their stock price be higher? Wouldn't they have more money? Wouldn't their impressive sales be more impressive? Like, if everybody was happy about everything, wouldn't that make the Apple owners, the shareholders, happy too? Well, of course it would. Well, I'll tell you what, I get to bitch a little bit and then move on with my life because I'm not the manufacturer of the number one selling device in the world. I don't have $380 billion in sales last year. They have got to make a choice just like I do, just like you do. We're going to do these things because if we do these things, we're giving up these other things. And these things that people think are easy, if we do these things, we can't do these other things. And Apple knows the full landscape of Apple's business. They know who they're going to fire next month, for instance. They know the shifts that are coming. They know that maybe they don't want to develop this thing that everybody wants right now because they want to develop the next thing that everybody's going to want. Is it always right? No. But my whole point is they can't make everyone happy. So if Apple, with $300+ billion in sales, with full teams of engineers that are bigger than a lot of companies, with full teams of developers that are bigger than a full PR department that's bigger than some companies, right? If they can't make everybody happy, how the hell could you do it? This, by its very nature, tells you that even legitimate requests from your family, your friends, or from the market cannot always be fulfilled, because to say yes is also to say no to something else. And one of the things we have to determine, though, when it's a market signal, is it even a signal? Is it emotional discharge or constructive friction? Right? Emotional discharge is the guy that hates the soccer mom polishing rocks. This is a person who should be immediately banned and forgotten. There is no reason to worry about what this person says ever again. A person who has the time to stop for even 10 seconds to insult a lady who has done nothing to harm him, whose biggest sin is being successful teaching kids how to make rocks shiny, that person who criticizes her, who throws hate at her, is a pathetic excuse for a human being, a waste of skin, and should go find the nearest tree and apologize to it for wasting the oxygen the tree made so that person can breathe. That's an easy one. You know, that's emotional discharge. And so much of what you hear is emotional discharge. When I first started this show, I didn't get a lot of pushback because I wasn't making a difference yet. But once it caught on, I mean, once I was up to like even 200, 300 subscribers on iTunes, all of a sudden the pushback started coming. I literally got people that told me I had no right. Now, you got to think again, this is early days of podcasting. Podcasting was officially invented, or I would say really became a thing when Apple added it to iTunes in 2005. So we're going back to 2008. So podcasting really only existed in the mainstream for 3 years, and very few people even really knew what it was at the time. So it had this kind of disruption that by proxy, any good podcaster was part of it, was offending people. This person told me I had no right to say the things what I was saying because, wait for it, you don't have a degree in broadcasting. And I'm thinking, well, first of all, do you think every radio host has a fucking degree in broadcasting? Second of all, you don't have to listen to me. If you don't like me, don't listen. Go away. But that was an emotional discharge. Something hit that person the wrong way. They were probably a person that initially liked what they heard on the show. But when I started saying things they disagreed with, instead of just saying, I'm not going to listen to this asshole anymore, they had to reach out with vitriol hate. I mean, this was serious hatred. And I've had plenty of these people over the years. I've had people send magazines to my house, changing my name from Spearco to Queerco. Like, how juvenile, how sophomorish is that? All we did was just throw the magazines in the shredder and stick it in the compost and go, great, free carbon. It didn't hurt me. I didn't have to pay for it. It's not my problem, right? But this kind of thing, this is an emotional discharge. This person's doing something, and I don't like the way they're doing it, and they're successful. And the bigger the success, the more the pushback, okay? That's the emotional discharge versus constructive friction. So the minute you know you're dealing with emotional discharge, you just forget. Let it go. Just don't even worry about it. You shouldn't be thinking about it. You know, as many times as it happened, I have these few stories because I've kind of filed them into the recall area of the brain so I can tell stories like this. I really don't give a shit about these people. I have no idea where they are now. They're not doing anything of consequence in my life or probably their own. Now, you also have to filter your feedback into clear categories. And again, to me, your clear categories, we start out with a macro of emotional discharge and constructive friction. But then when we get into constructive friction, we need to look at, is this from an informed source? Do they matter? Is there an emotional component in it, even though it's constructive, like your mom or dad advising you about your future or what job to take or what loan to take or not take or what to buy when you get a new car, right? Those are constructive, but they're also emotionally led on some levels, right? So you have to filter that. And so when we start filtering it, we can move into things like, when do we look at something and fix it? When do we actually take the feedback and say, you know what, that's legitimate? I have the resources to change it, or I can acquire the resources to change it. I'm going to put it on an action list. Like, this is happening like this week or this month. Like, I'm going to do the thing because this thing needs to be done. Well, first of all, you have to look at it from a standpoint of, if I do this, will it really have a net positive effect on my goal? So if I'm in business, will this affect revenue to the positive? Or will failing to do it eventually affect revenue to the negative? It's probably on the list once we get into more sorting anyway. It's probably at least going to get ticked as a box to examine further, right? Or if the answer is no, yeah, this would be nice, but I'm not going to make any more money because of this. I'm not going to get any more subscribers because of this. Or if I'm trying to lose weight, I'm not going to lose another pound because of this. I'm not going to be more motivated to stay on my plan because of this, right? If it's a recommendation to go to college, if I'm not going to make any more money going to college than not going to college, I'm probably not going to college because college costs money. If I'm going to spend money, I got to make money. So we have to start filtering it into clear categories. And, you know, somebody asked a question and threw me a $20 super chat, so I really wanted to work it in. I think I can work it in here. Lazarus Rex said, just listen to episode 3696, 10 shifts, degrees. Is it responsible? Is it reasonable to think you could get a better or at least 80% ROI compared to a year in college just by self-learning with online tools? The return might be infinite in reality when you look at it that way. And here's why. What's a year in college right now? I mean, I'm not talking community college. I'm talking what most people do. So first of all, a year in college is probably worthless today. Like, if you're on a resume, I went to college for 1 year and quit, you might actually be in worse shape than I went to college for 0 years and I don't have a degree. Why'd you quit? If you're still in school, maybe it helps, maybe, but then I've got to have you split between your responsibilities as an employee and a student. So 1 year in college is probably worthless. So let's do it as, would it be better to have a self-directed learning plan or a degree? Well, what if your degree costs you $100,000 and you do get a good job and it's in your field of study, at least sort of, and you make $10,000 a year more than you would have otherwise for 10 years. At 10 years of working, you've just broken even just by the numbers. Now, it's also probably the case that to pay that loan off, it's going to cost you $200,000 with interest by the time you're done. So at the end of 10 years, you probably still owe more money, right? And while you've come up with experience with that degree, it's only gone so far. Well, the person I find that actually really attacks things without the degree, their experience compounds much more rapidly because they're the kind of person who's already set off on a self-learning footprint. So they're going to make more out of a job from the learning aspect than the person who feels entitled because they have the degree. I don't think there's any way that you would not benefit if it's possible to do what you want to do by avoiding a university at this point. If it's not possible, or if the really great jobs always require degrees, that changes the calculus. But 70%, 80% of people that have jobs with college degrees, their degree is not even important to their job. So you do the math on it for yourself. But yeah, when we have something that's broken, we need to ask, can I fix this now? Like, and will it matter? And if the answer is yes, then we should get on it. We also need to figure out, like, when do we save it? Because it's valid but not urgent, or it's valid, and I would even say it's really important, but I just can't do it right now. I just can't. Maybe because, you know, I have a hell of a lot of business already, and if I try to fix this thing that's not going to crater my business, I'm going to crater my business by not taking care of my customers. Maybe I'm just not at a place for it yet. So if I'm some sort of content creator and somebody suggests some sort of huge enhancement to my studio equipment, maybe I want to set that as a goal, but maybe that's a next year goal. Maybe I don't see the value in increasing the studio quality of my production until my audience is bigger in the first place. Maybe I actually want to leverage the fact that I'm kind of gorilla in what I'm doing with my audience now because they're a little more forgiving to me just because I'm in that space. Maybe you're asking for an enhancement to a software suite that my little company builds, but I know if I do that, even though that's something I eventually want to do, there's all these other things that are on the development plan this year, and it's just better that those things happen first. It's not that you're wrong. You're just trying to cut to the front of the line with your suggestion, and it needs to stay. Maybe I already have a plan to do it. So that if I already have a plan to do it, but it's out there, that reinforces the value of the decision I made. At least somebody wants it. You know, another thing you have to ask is the person who's saying you need to do it willing to pay for it? You know, before the days of AI, when transcriptions could just be created, I'd be like, transcribe your podcast. I want to read it. I don't want to listen. Bro, you transcribe it yourself. You know, so I put out a thing way, way back in the early days. I'll get a transcription service, and I'll have somebody else do this. And it's going to cost me about $200 an episode to have it done right, where it's not like computer. Because we even had computer-generated shit back then, and it sucked, okay? So, like, to have somebody do it right, it's going to be $200 an episode. If you'll pay $10 a month for transcripts, because, you know, back then I was doing 5 shows a week. It's 25 shows, and I'm going to spend all this money. If you'll spend $10 a month on a subscription for transcripts and enough people will do it, then I'll get the service hooked up and start providing them. Do you know how many people said they were actually willing to pay for it, $10 a month, but I'm supposed to pay $200 an episode? None. So right there, yes, it would be nice. Yes, there's some advantage to it, but it's going to cost me more than it's going to result in, and all the people that said they want it aren't willing to pay for it. So when you tell a company or a business producer, a service provider, anything that you want, the first question anybody with a brain on that other end should be asking is, but will you pay for it? I want this. I want that. I want that. Well, yeah, but are you going to pay for it? Because there is this sense of entitlement in the internet age among any internet audience that they feel entitled to whatever they ask for from their favorite content producer who they help out by watching and liking. We appreciate it, but it doesn't pay the bills in of itself. So we have to look at every request, right? So a lot of times it's just that we're going to say, yes, that goes in the queue, but it goes down the line. Because then the next thing is we skip it. It's not my problem to solve, right? I mean, there are certain things in life that any company, any service provider, or any family member, any friend or whatever can say, yeah, it would be great if I could do that for you, but I can't do everything. And that's on the list of never. I'm not doing that for you. If you want that, you'll have to do it for yourself. That's exactly what happened to me with the transcriptions. You want a transcription service? The transcription service cost me. Again, this is going back. This is like, I know today you can do it for a lot less, but this is going back into like 2010, about $200 an episode. This is what you said you wanted. If you're paying $10, I need 20 people per episode, right? 25 episodes. I need 500 freaking people. 500 people to break even. can't get one, it goes on the never list. Like, the only time it's ever been revisited is when I'm explaining something like this. I'm never doing it. Today, it can be done for free, so do it yourself. If nobody would pay for it when it wasn't free, and you could do it yourself for free now, then I'm not doing it for you. Because clearly you didn't value it enough. Like, this business idea I had today, I'm not going to go into it, but, you know, one of my things is, as we move into more and more with things like lightning payments, like we have on the Nostr network and whatever, you know, when somebody zaps me on Nostr for a measly 5 sats, which is like a penny, right? Not even, it's like half a penny. It means more to me than a like on X or Facebook, because they actually put some value in, even though it's a tiny amount. So I was thinking about ways like that we could create things like certain providers that would use the platform, you could tip them. And that would actually send feedback that the thing you were tipped for actually had value. Clicking a thumbs up is nice. I appreciate it when it happens. It doesn't actually put dollars on the table, and it doesn't cost you anything to do it. So this is what we have to always be filtering. It's not my problem to solve, either because it will not actually make what I'm doing more profitable or better for me, or sometimes it's just not my problem to solve. Like, if it's something that you're asking for, that I can clearly look at the technological landscape, and I know, like, in a year or so, there's going to be a tool that does this for anybody that wants it for free, or it'll be cheap, and they can buy that tool and use it for other things than just my service, like automatic transcription. I'm not doing it. It's not my problem to solve. The industry is going to solve it as a whole, and if I can't make money on it doing it for the industry, if it's only for me, I'll let somebody else do it. It's a pretty simple solution when you think about it. And you can't please everyone, and you shouldn't try. There is an old Aesop's fable, and it's the man, the boy, and the donkey. And here's the abbreviated version of the Aesop fable. So this man and the boy and his donkey are walking to the market, and when they get there, their plan is to sell the donkey because they need money. And so they're walking along, and they're leading the donkey. And the crowd starts shouting at them as they walk by, "Look at those idiots. They're morons. They have a donkey, and yet they're walking. Why don't they ride the donkey?" So the man puts the boy on the donkey and says, "Yeah, let's let the kid ride the donkey." So he leads the donkey with the boy riding. And then the crowd starts saying, "Spoiled child, let the old man ride the donkey." So the kid gets off and the old man gets on the donkey. And they say, "Petulant child, you know, or horrible old man, let the child ride." Well, they already tried that. So they both get on the donkey, and the crowd starts yelling at them because you're overburdening the donkey, the poor donkey. Look what you're doing to the donkey. So they get off the donkey, but they realize, like, we already got yelled at when we were leading the donkey. So the two of them pick up and carry the donkey. Then they become a laughing stock. Eventually, they're going across the bridge. They drop the donkey into the river, and they lose the donkey. So now they have nothing, and the reason they have nothing is they tried to please everyone. Yeah? And this is, if you try to please everyone, this is how it's put in a kind of American, you know, blunt, just colloquialism today. You try to please everyone, you end up losing your ass. In other words, you end up losing the only thing of value you had, in this case, maybe your business, because you spent so much time trying to please every single person that asked for something from you. You're trying to address every bit of criticism, right? When you're doing that, you can't focus on your core business. If it's not a business, if it's, you know, getting a degree, if it's getting into shape, if it's learning a skill, you can't focus on your core requirements to complete your goal because you're worried about what all these other people think. This all has to be filtered out. It all has to be filtered out. And you have to carry your own goals and not let other people's fears steer your choices. And what I mean by that is, you know, when I bought my first second house and decided to rent it out, I did have members of my family, not just my brother-in-law, tell me how risky it was. And if you care about the people giving you advice at all, and you have any value as to their knowledge, their intelligence, you can't help but take a little bit of it in. And whenever you're doing something new, different, especially for the first time and making a major decision in your life, like buying a house, going to school, joining the military, there's always self-doubt. You always have some self-doubt. There's always an internal battle to overcome. And the person trying to help really doesn't realize they're piling on with that internal battle, with that piece of yourself that's telling you, maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe it is too risky. Maybe I'm not ready to open my own restaurant yet. If you've been working in restaurants your whole life and you're ready to go out and not just be an executive chef, but actually open your own store, maybe I'm not ready. Maybe it would just be easier to stay in this like number two position at this great place where I have a guaranteed good salary instead of taking all this risk. And when they come in and they start saying, well, that's really risky. Have you really thought it through? Well, of course I've thought it through. If I'm to the point of going to a bank for a small business loan, I've probably thought it through. If it's something I'm doing in an industry that I've been in for 20 years, I've probably thought it through, and I probably know more than you do about it. It doesn't mean they can't get in your head. And there's actually some people, and I believe some of them do it intentionally, and some do it just, it's kind of what they do. They don't really mean it. They do it almost maliciously in that they know, at least subconsciously, what they're doing. They know they're manipulating you. They know they're trying to not just share their concerns, but you put you in touch with your own fears. Like a salesman trying to sell you life insurance, one of the things they say in that industry is you need to back up the hearse and let them smell the flowers. What will happen to your wife, Mr. Smith, if you died right now? That's a closing technique in life insurance, okay? That's a closing technique. And I'll tell you how you really do it. If you really want to fire this up, if you're selling life insurance to a married person, you have to have both of them in front of you. You'll never get a close. And if you do, you'll get a cancellation if you don't get them both in front of you. You have to get them both in front of you. And so you figure out which one of them is the primary income earner. It's usually the guy, not always. And which one is kind of the dominant personality. Again, usually the guy, not always. Okay. And you're so most of the time in that scenario, you're selling them a wife. She's more in touch with mortality than the guy is. Guys, you know, we do crazy shit because we think everybody's going to die but me, right? So you kill the husband. You say, Frank, what would happen to Alice if you died right now? In fact, let's run an experiment. You just died. Alice, what do you do? I'm going to tell you flat out, Frank is going to try to speak. He's going to say, wait a minute, not Frank, I hate to do it, brother, you're dead. I want to hear from Alice. What would you do if he was on his way to work tomorrow, no fault of his own, semi-truck, runs a red light, smashes into him and his income are gone? What do you do? That approach is, honestly, shitty and evil as it is incredibly effective at selling life insurance. It's one of the most effective closing turn points that you can make if you've gotten that far in a discussion with a couple about their life insurance needs. They may not buy from you, but they're probably within the next 30 days buying from someone. They may get a better price, better policy, whatever. But at that point, you just closed down the main objection, but you did it with fear. There is a lot of this fear in the well-meaning advice of friends and family. They have a fear, and it's also back to, remember what I said about change, when you're forcing a change, and let's dig into that for a little bit, because this is a really important component to understand. I mentioned services like Uber and Lyft. Obviously, they create friction in the industry that they're disrupting, which is the taxi cab industry. Now, the thing about Uber and Lyft is, yes, they disrupted the taxi cab industry, but tell me there's not millions of people around the world that use services like Uber and Lyft that never would have used a taxi. I mean, to get a taxi in Dallas-Fort Worth, you have to make a phone call, and you have to wait. And you might wait a long time, and it's really expensive. And you get the same shitty yellow cab service every time. Or you call a very expensive, like, town car level and above limo service. Those are your two choices. And either way, you got to make a phone call and you got to wait. Uber and Lyft come out, doesn't matter where you are. As long as you got your smartphone, which didn't exist before all of this, right? The phone had to come first. You click a button, pick me up where I am right now. What's available? It'll tell you like base level, what do they call it, X or whatever, and then like the black service and the, you know, whatever they call the, I think X is the larger service, whatever. You pick like more room, more comfort, base level car, whatever you want. $35. Boop, 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 boop. Here comes the car, right? So that's how they actually became as disruptive, by being more available and have better, lower cost and more available service and a service availability everywhere instead of service availability in New York and Chicago and LA, right? You want a cab in one of those three cities, at least before Uber and Lyft, you could pretty much walk out in the street in most like the downtown areas, wait long enough and wave a cab down. You want one in Dallas? That ain't happening. You'll never see one. But of course, the initial friction, right, was against the taxi industry. That's who had a problem with it. The people that first had a problem with Airbnb were hotels. Because before Airbnb, when you were going to go stay in a city, you always looked up a hotel, and because that was really your only option. You had like low-level shitty hotel, mid-level hotel, or high-end hotel. Those were your choices. And in some places, you didn't have an option for anything below, you know, above shitty. If you were stuck someplace where you really didn't want to be, which we often are, all of a sudden Airbnb and what have you and Vibro and et cetera come around. And now, if you're traveling anywhere, I don't even care if you're like, yeah, a hotel will work for this. You should at least check the Airbnb options, because you might find you could stay in a house for a lot less money and have some amenities that you'll never have at a hotel. Or you might find you prefer a hotel. Either way is fine. But those are very obvious friction points, right? You have a direct competitor entering a market where that type of competitor has never existed before and an established base resisting the disruption. Fine. How the hell does that pertain to like small business people? How does that pertain to you and your life and what have you? It is the change you're forcing is in the individual's mind. And people actually get way more upset about being forced to change their mind than to change their physical reality, right? I have to get a new computer. I will go buy a new computer. You know, when we made certain changes like analog inputs just kind of went away and you need a digital antenna if you don't have cable. Gravel, gravel, grass, grass, but go buy the antenna. You have something to change your mind. Well, that's a whole different effing thing, isn't it? Right? If you ask somebody to change their mind, think about trying to change somebody's mind about a small, tiny, little political issue that's not even attached to a big name politician. They get pissed. Try to tell somebody something isn't true that they know and believe to be true that's not even important, like the boiling frog analogy. You know the boiling frog? It's bullshit. It's not true. Some of you are pissed right now. I'm sorry. I'm not going to apologize for the truth. If you put a frog in water that it's comfortable for the frog, and you very slowly heat the water, yes, long before the frog is in danger, it will try to get out of the water. It will not sit there until it boils to death, never knowing its impending death is coming. Reptiles and amphibians do a thing called thermoregulation. But some of you are resisting this right now because you've heard the story so many times or because you told the story. That resistance to this new information you're being given and the discomfort it causes you, and by the way, it is conclusively proven, one, because I am an amateur herpetologist and you can trust me, right? I studied, especially as a kid, deeply into reptiles and amphibians. I have kept countless snakes, lizards, frogs, turtles my whole life. And the first thing you do when you set up a habitat is what? Create a thermal gradient, meaning you have a hot side and a cold side of the enclosure, and the animal is able to move back and forth as it pleases and find its current Goldilocks zone. It usually doesn't end up completely on the hot or completely on the cold. It usually ends up somewhere in the middle. And if it's a snake and it eats, then it goes and basks in the heat, a digestion. And when it's done digesting and it's tired, it kind of retreats over into a cool area and sleeps, because now it's dietary and it doesn't work like us. It's not going to eat again for another week or two or three, right? So they thermoregulate. So the idea that an animal that has to thermoregulate because it's cold-blooded wouldn't notice an increase in temperature is retarded. If that's not good enough for you, the Mythbusters guys, Jamie and Adam, did a Mythbusters episode on the boiling frog myth and disproved it conclusively that it would ever be true. So if you have a mental block to that information, imagine now the person who thinks, I'm brilliant, I should have success in my life, and I don't, and I don't know why. Somebody must have screwed me over, and they see soccer mom with 750,000 followers polishing rocks. It's not just that he's a spiteful little twit. It's that his mind cannot accept the change required here to understand the reality on the ground. Blaze, basically, you're going to put a person into a point, and it doesn't matter if they're the twit on TikTok. It doesn't matter if it's your best friend or a family member advising you about your life. You're putting them into a place where they're looking at what you're doing. And that the reason they have issue with it is it's something they didn't do, they couldn't do, they wouldn't do. And they never thought it would work. And when it starts working for you, they have two choices, and only really two choices. One would be to admit that they were wrong, to admit that what you're doing is actually working. And that means that whatever failures they have are their own, and therefore they're responsible for their own success and failure in life more than any other individual factor. Or two. Two is to assume that if you're successful on TikTok, somebody at TikTok pushed a button and made you successful. Or it just happens to be that maybe you did it on your own, but that just means all of your followers are nothing but a bunch of idiots, and you can't possibly actually really be successful just because of the numbers alone. Doesn't matter. We can look up any creator's income potential on TikTok once they're over a certain level and see how much it's worth just in TikTok advertisements that get kicked back to a creator, or a YouTube channel, same thing, right? They'll still, like, in their head say they can't possibly actually be successful with this, because you're asking them to change their opinion, not about you, but about themselves. Now, knowing what you know about people in general, do you think it's more likely that a person is willing to change their opinion about themselves when they run into contradictory information, like this person that I think that I'm better than is far more successful than me? Or do you think that it's more likely that they'll come up with an excuse so that they can entrench themselves in why they were right in the first place? Now, here's the thing. You could put that question to most kids in eighth or ninth grade, and they'll go right to number two. We instinctively know that's true. So with all of that in mind, we have to be able to look at this feedback that we get when we're trying to improve our lives and sort it. And again, I want to go through the sorting real quick, and then we'll wrap up. We're going to sort it into, this is all noise. This is all emotional discharge. This is somebody that is not thinking clearly at all. They're not trying to help, even if they think they are, because sometimes the person that's just an emotional discharge person really thinks they're trying to help, right? This person, the only thing I should do with this person is ignore them. And if they become a chronic problem and it's something online or something, block them. That's it. That's the totality of it. It's done. Then we have true signal. And true signal usually breaks down into one of three things. The first one is, it is a legitimate observation that there is a defect in what you are doing, and it can be reasonably quickly addressed, and doing so will improve your situation. You should probably act on it. And the more people that tell you the same thing, the more it's probably true. Okay? The second one is, everything I said is true, except you cannot get it done now. And other things are more important now than the thing that you're being told about. Even if a lot of people are you telling it, they don't run your business or your life. So they don't know what you know. So they're saying this is the most important thing, and you're going, this thing is important, but it goes over here. It doesn't go here in the front of the line. I have to do these other things first, and you have to make that call for yourself. And then there is the legitimate signal that's a legitimate suggestion, but it's either never going to actually benefit you, or you do not have and will not have, at least any time in a reasonable time frame, the resources to do it. This is, you know, where idea guy comes and says, you should just build a service that does X, Y, and Z. Why don't you do it? Well, I don't have the resources. Yeah, neither do I. All right? So that goes in the never to, it's out there in space, right? It's on the shelf. It's hanging on the wall. Maybe I'll get to it someday. And maybe I won't. You know? You have to filter that way. And if you don't filter that way, you're just going to never really benefit from the positive feedback that comes in. You always are going to have to make that determination. I do have a couple starred things, but I think they're both people that threw me some super chats. Lazarus Rex, I already answered your question. Amy B says, gas money, thanks, Jack, and a $20 super chat. Amy, thank you. I really appreciate that. That was really kind of you to send my way. If anybody has any questions, go ahead and get them in now. Word question in all caps. I'm going to go ahead and start closing up today. I'm going to tell you that if I was a little bit off today, I apologize for it. The reality is that not only did we have the disruption to the show with the failed internet twice, we also have Jack with a pretty bad back spasm, and I've been fighting the whole thing, and it's pulled my focus off a few things, and I know I've hit on a few things I wanted to say that I didn't, so I apologize for that. We're all human, and we all have our limits. But today's item of the day, if you want to help support the show, other than by becoming a member of the MSB, one of the ways to do that is do all your online shopping, simply beginning at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. My item of the day today, I'm bringing around. I haven't had it around for about 2 months, but this is one of the most used devices in my kitchen. It's the Hamilton Beach 3-in-1 electric egg cooker. This thing makes omelets, and it makes poached eggs. The poached eggs, I'm going to tell you, put them in the thing that they give you to make omelets in, and it works a hell of a lot better than the one they do for the poached eggs. It really does. But the poached eggs are okay, and the omelets are really good. But the real thing it does is it makes perfect boiled eggs. Soft yolk, medium yolk, hard yolk, your choice. Once you have it dialed in for what you're doing and how much water to use and all, it's every single time exactly the way that you want it. But the big thing is, even farm fresh eggs, when you cook them with this thing, they peel easy. They peel beautifully. And in the write-up on this product, I also gave you guys a recipe for a deviled egg using avocado instead of mayo and bacon and cheese. And it is the bomb. It is fantastic. This item I didn't bring out until November last year on T-Spaz. November. For 2024, even though I brought it out in November, it was the number one best-selling item on T-Spaz. Because I guess because a lot of you guys keep chickens, and everybody likes boiled eggs. If they're boiled the way they want them, it's nailing it every time and have them be peelable. So this thing is awesome, and it's about $20. I learned about it from my nephew and his wife. I guess I call her my niece-in-law because they're always making deviled eggs at events and things, and I love deviled eggs. And like, well, why don't you cook all the time? Why don't you make them? And I'm like, because I don't like friggin' peeling them. And they pulled this thing out, and they said it, and they told me how it worked and showed it to me. And I said, you know, screw it. It's $20. I'll go home and buy one. If it doesn't really work for me, it's $20. I probably wouldn't even return it. It's never going anywhere. I love it. It is a fantastic piece of kitchen kit. With that, I don't see any questions that came in, so I will wrap up today. Again, I apologize for the technology disruptions today with internet feed problems, which makes no sense. It really doesn't as to how that worked itself out. And I apologize if I missed an item or two because of back spasms. Everybody's human. I'll catch you guys tomorrow with a new episode, and thanks for tuning in today.
They said you should have a house.